All stations, all stations, all call signs. This is Wrecker Actual, over. Stand by for transmission. Prepare to copy. This is American Vindicta. Today is Memorial Day, a time to remember those dearest to us that have fallen and will rise no more, a time to remember the man and woman who took the title of warrior, who fought for our country, who fought for the day that we now have, for a day that they surrendered freely. This Memorial Day, I recall all of those whom I knew and have lost. Some whose bands, three of them I have sitting right here on my desk. Men that I've served with, and many like you who are listening to me now that are also veterans that have served with you, you have lost. Those who have given the ultimate sacrifice, who signed a check, and the weight of it was their life for the freedom and the way of life of the American people. I debated on whether or not I would say very much today, for it is Memorial Day. But in the respects of those that I served with, for I served in the Marine Corps, from 2006 to 2010. My hat's off to you, dear brothers and friends, who, like I, have lost those you love, who bore the brunt of the ultimate sacrifice for we Americans who still live today. And may we remember the fallen, for this is why we still fight. As many did back then, they killed for the living and they killed for the dead. And as those of us who press on forward in this war, we fight for the living and we fight for the dead. Those who wished to see us in victory. But we come through dark times now. So I ask, in the spirit of the fallen, press on. Godspeed. Continue the fight. For the fight is righteous. Thank you. Be watchful. Stand firm in the faith. Act like men. Be strong. Let all that you do be done in love. 1 Corinthians 16:13-14. If you'll turn your Bibles to 1 Corinthians 15, starting at verse 50, we read about the mystery and victory. This passage I dedicate to the fallen warriors of America. I tell you this, brothers, flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, nor does the perishable inherit the imperishable. Behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet. For the trumpet will sound, And the dead will be raised imperishable, and we shall be changed. For this perishable body must put on the imperishable, and this immortal body must put on immortality. When the perishable puts on the imperishable, and the mortal puts on immortality, then shall come to pass the saying that is written, "Death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting?" The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God, who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. And for those of the fallen who served across all the branches of our military, your death was not in vain. Thank you for your service. Thank you for your dedication. Thank you to the families of the fallen. What we have coming in this country is a train wreck that's been waiting to happen for as long as it has been planned to happen. I have been reading up on headlines, news articles, debating on whether or not I would want to talk about any of it. The Lord has put onto my heart so much to give more of a ministry approach, I guess you would say, to this radio show than to be more of a everyday just news headlines kind of thing. But some things must be addressed. As a veteran, I see a wayward nation that has changed so much since the wars in Iraq first began and in Afghanistan. I remember in high school, like many of you, when we signed up to go to war because of 9/11. How many of you remember where you were when the Twin Towers fall? That became a popular song by Alan Jackson. Many other pop cultures ended up making millions off of these types of lyrics. But where were they? Where were you? Do you still remember it? Do you remember when that first plane hit? I watched the second plane fly straight into the other tower. I was in eighth grade. I'm 36 years old now, so some of you may have a few years on me. But I was in eighth grade. My math teacher turned on the TV back when we had the big box TVs. Turned on the TV, put on whatever local news it was, and we saw within minutes another plane flying right into the other tower. So many conspiracies have been said about that day since it started. There's plenty of conspiracies still left open. Nobody knows what in the hell hit the Pentagon. But we do know that the hijackers now had quite a lot to do with the CIA. Saudi Arabia had something to do with that apparently as well. But because of that, we sent our men and women to Iraq and Afghanistan to bring freedom, to end tyranny, overthrow a dictator, to stop weapons of mass destruction, just like World War I, the war to end all wars, as it was called, America was thrusted into war after war after war. And for the millions that have died for this country, I guess the most upsetting thing now is the erosion of history. As someone who wanted to become a history teacher for high school students, I'm particularly aggrieved at the erosion of history by our own politicians. Well, let's just say the blatant disregard of our history and how much it should matter, right? You know, what we have going on currently in Ukraine is not just a series of problems, but it's a manufactured problem. I had a listener who left a comment for me, and I would like to share it so that we can all talk about it, about Ukraine, because this will be the next war that we get to send our men and women to. Another meat grinder that the politicians will beg and plead for the Americans to send their young loved ones over to war while they will sit here in their $2,000 suits, eating their $500 steak meals bought by their constituents as they are moving back and forth across America, garnering hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars to be able to stay in their seats. Some of them are veterans. Thank you for your service. 98% of them are not, but are more than willing to thrust us into the fray. There's no connection. Before we get here, I want to say something. This is no offense to anybody listening. This is just going to be a standard bitching that has been needing to be said by me for quite some time. But for some of you out there who don't understand my melancholy attitude, my graveyard sense of humor, and for some of you Karens out there who think I actually care about your comment, or that I care, honestly, if I offend you, and then you have the audacity to tell me how I should act, how I should speak, how I should, in your mind, be representing the kingdom. I ask some of you out there, what have you done? Where have you been? Besides doing a few meaningful tasks in your life, what have you contributed? Me and Jamie Walden just had this conversation about a few people who love to send me and him and some others like us who decided to go in the path of ministry. They love to send us their hate mail. And you'll find this entertaining, but Christians are the absolute worst. The absolute worst. Do you know how many agnostics or atheists have sent me nasty grams? That many. Zero. But it's always from the body of Christ, which shows you that the roots of this tree are starting to rot. The erosion, I guess you could say, of Christianity is really starting to show itself here in America as we all decide which side we're going to take a position on, I guess you could say. And instead of uniting, instead of spreading gossip and rumors and backfighting and beating each other over the head with different theology, or Doug reads from an ESV, he's not a real Christian because he doesn't read from a King James, which is the only Bible you should read from. Do you know how many people have sent me an email about that? saying, "Brother, this is a gentle rebuke, but you should only read from the King James." You know, for the amount of people who love to tell me their opinions and love to grandstand in the comment section or send me an amusing email, I ask you, what have you done? Besides leaving an interesting comment about your opinion, what have you done? What have you contributed? So for today, which is Memorial Day, I'm going to say a few things that just need to be said. Now remember, I don't get friendship pay. I'm not here to give you a whimsical idea of what American vindicta is supposed to mean. This is America's anger that we are talking about, a righteous anger, something I see very little in pastors nowadays. And for me, I guess you could say, I wake up almost every day wanting to chew someone's head off. That's just the way God made me. I'm 100 miles per hour all the time. But I have to sit back in retrospect and think about what the Word of God is trying to teach me. And what I feel is that righteous indignation from the old prophets to the apostles, even to our Lord, when you see the apostasy that's going on in Christianity right now, especially in America, and then you see this reprobate nature of America, to include many Christians, I have to sit back and I wonder, all this is happening right now, we're in relative peacetime. Yeah, stuff may be going on in Ukraine, but we're not in war. Not yet. Not in the way that I was in and some of you were in. All right. What happens to you weak-minded Christians, you jellyfish Christians? Your backbone is about as slippery as a snake. What happens to you when we get thrusted into war, real war? How much of a constitution do you have in your own faith, in your own walk with Christ? Because some of you out there, you talk the talk, but you've never walked the walk. But yet you walk around assuredly telling us all how you're ready. You're ready for the war. You're ready for Christ's return. But yet how many right now are committed enough to go out and proclaim the gospel? How many of you right now would go to communist China and proclaim the gospel openly? These questions that I'm asking you are going to be relative to our future, because we are so closely bound for totalitarianism in this country, for a dictatorship in this country by a political party, no longer a man. It's by party. Like the Nazis. They too, when they get into this power, and it's, you think Joe Biden and these current day leftists are the problem? Wait till you see the new problem. There will come, dear friends, in time, a communist revolution in America. And if we're not careful, if we're not diligent, not just with our prayers, but with our actions, they will win. They will take over. They're winning in the schools. They're winning in politics. They're winning in big tech. They're winning in big pharma. And one day, they're going to shut down the churches. They're going to shut down the printing press. We'll be like North Korea. You'll have one of 8 sanctioned haircuts that you're allowed to have. What are we going to do on that day? And everything that's going on in politics right now has a little of something to do with this. The erosion of our border. Look at how many communists are coming through the border right now. People are all concerned because there's rapists and violent people and gangs and terrorists that are coming across. Hey, that's true. That's happening. But do you know the amount of communists that are coming through the border? Not just from China, but from all over the world. And the ones coming through the border are going to do nothing more than meet up with the ones that are already in your middle schools, high schools, colleges. We are being quickly outnumbered. Many of you don't understand. Many of you don't understand the real thing that's happening right now. Many of you, unfortunately, don't get the real goal that's happening. It's being told to you everywhere. From the movies to the comic books, the music, the commercials, the TV shows. The goal is a new world order. The goal is to shut down individual rights, to liquidate the competition, to destroy the fundamental values that Christianity has. To completely erode every constitutional right. Christians, we built this nation, and we are the ones who are allowing it to be destroyed. That's why we should be so hard on one another. This is our not just our country. This is our empire. America is an empire. If you go back to the original works of the founding fathers, the framers of the Constitution, they fought for this. They said, don't you let it go. Don't you stop fighting. Don't let outside influence destroy what we've given you. Well, we have because of an endless cycle. Some of you know of this endless cycle. So what is that endless cycle? The engine of cyclic history, restoration, involution. Say it with me. Hard times create strong men. Strong men create good times. Good times create weak men. Weak men create hard times. We live in an era of weak men. And the strong men are overshadowed by their weakness. But that means that we too are becoming weak. Doesn't it? Hard thing to admit, isn't it? Why would we allow the abortion clinics? Would ancient Israel? Why would we allow the detransformation of children from their original genders to something mutilated? Would ancient Israel? Why would we allow our politics to be subverted, diluted, poisoned by outside influences and strange gods? Did that happen in ancient Israel? And why is it that we know right from wrong, that we know the word of the true and living God, but we choose to be found wanting? What is the penalty for these sins? In ancient Israel's time, the penalty was always an invasion. An invasion from outside forces, that God would gather up, God would rise up the enemies of Israel and bring them against his one love, the land, the people of Israel. He was a jealous God. Then, do you think he's not now? You read in Matthew 24, the wars and rumors of wars. All these chaotic times. All these things that are going to come. But the end is not yet. So many more things are going to happen. And it's going to catch a lot of people off balance. It'll surprise quite a few people who right now are stuck in this mindset that this will pass. All this is normal. It's just the cyclic rate of history. You know what happens to countries when they become communist? The graveyards grow in population. That's what happens. That is what's happening. I debate myself sometimes if a revolution is really going to change anything. If a civil war is really going to change anything after the dust falls and settles, who will be left standing? Would it have been worth it? Or should all of this have been done a long time ago by our forebears? Well, it wasn't. It didn't. So now it's our problem. You can't look back into the Civil War. That's too far gone. No, this happened during the Industrial Revolution, World War I, World War II, and so forth. As communism grew, as Marxist-Leninist grew in this country because of the Cold War and the infiltration from them, the infiltration of Nazism, and all the other strange Eastern religions that came over here in the 1800s. The whole world has been standing against us. And as long as we remained faithful to God, it seemed that we would lose no war. We were always granted a victory. But the more we slip away from God, the more his hand of protection comes away from America. And eventually, you have to ask yourself, when does our luck run out? When is his protection taken away? And what in the hell do I do when that happens? It's a good question, friends. I don't have a good answer for you. All I can tell you is that the answers lie in this book. That doesn't mean that the answers to restoring our Constitution and saving our country is in the Bible. But the answers to you alone are in this book. In this book. Only in the Bible can I look and I say, you know what? I may not be able to stop all this, but I can tell you this much. I can save my soul. And God willing, if just one of you listening that was ever like me can be saved, then all that I have been doing is worth it. If it wasn't for the fact that I had one day stumbled upon a show called The Hagman Report, I might not have ever gotten into any of this, guys. It was Doug Hagman's show. I was in New Jersey working for Homeland Security. And I had left Camden, New Jersey, which was where my office was out of, lovely city of Camden, murder capital of the country in 2012. And I was traveling to the eastern shore of New Jersey. And along the way, I was like listening to George Norrie and a bunch of other stuff about like paranormal stuff. And I had stumbled across the Hagman Report. And they had these two guys on there. And for some reason, I decided to listen to it. These two guys were Pastor David Lankford and Steve Quayle. And after listening to those two men together, the hook was in and I was turned. And my heart slowly started being turned from the way I was going into where I am now. It's a long road, many mistakes made along the way, many of things I should have done better and stopped doing. But much like Paul, I look back and I say, you know, if it wasn't for a direct intervention from Christ in my life, I don't want to know where I would be right now. But it took a direct intervention from Christ to pull me out of the depths of hell that I was walking right into. If you turn to Luke chapter 12, verse 49, I want to read a little bit of something to you. I was listening to a pastor the other day. And he said, you know what one of the problems with pastors in America is right now is that they have no sense of danger. They grew up typically in areas where, you know, you just don't comprehend what danger is. You don't comprehend what evil is. You don't, because of that, understand the signs and the times that we are living in. Even to this day, I don't understand how a pastor can be democratic and be a pastor anymore. That's a strange one, isn't it? Luke 12, starting at 49, titled, Not Peace, But Division. I came to cast fire on the earth. I would that it were already kindled. I have baptism to be baptized with, and how great is my distress until it is accomplished. Do you think that I have come to give you peace on earth? No, I tell you, but rather division. For from now on, in one house there will be five divided, three against two, two against three. There will be divided father against son, son against father, mother against daughter, and daughter against mother, mother-in-law against her daughter-in-law, and daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. I find it interesting how I can almost always open up to the Bible and find chapters and verses that are so relative to what's going on today. Never before in America have we been so divided about everything, about anything. I would say that even with the hippie revolution, never before have children been so divisive towards their parents. As a father raising five children, my wife and I have our own problems, obviously, with kids, as you all do. All you parents, you know, you have some problems with kids every now and then. But, you know, the main constant in my children's lives is the word of God, which is what we judge by, nurture by, study by. That is the standard for our family. I think the problem in America is that people have lost that standard. And they're too busy keeping up with the Joneses. New car, new house, new addition, more vacations, new this, new that. How many of you are satisfied, though? You know, there's a difference between wealth and that satisfaction. Socrates, I believe, is the one who said, wealth consists not in having great possessions, but in having few wants. How many of you right now are entitled to your great possessions, sold to them, slaved to them, your sports cars, your $500,000 homes that you'll work your entire life for? This is the way and order of life now in America. More money, bigger house, newest stuff, no content. We all struggle with that, I think. I think one of the other problems here in America is that we understand quite a bit, but we don't comprehend exactly what we understand. One of the problems that I've dealt with younger adults is that comprehension level. And I'm amazed when I talk to younger people, when we talk about politics, talk about religion, geopolitics, war, law, and how the younger generation can barely understand half of what I'm talking about. They're disinterested for the most part. But yet, they understand games, music, movies, stupid things. We have two ears and one mouth so that we can listen twice as much as we speak. What I see currently, not just in the younger generation, but also with pastors, is I see quite a bit of talking, very little listening, very little understanding, very little comprehension. And just because something happens in front of you doesn't mean you have to respond to it. Doesn't mean you have to say something about it. Monitoring, observing, comprehending, and calculating. That should be the way of most men. But instead, it's reaction, reaction, reaction. This is, of course, the way of geopolitics for America. We're very reactionary. That's why we don't, I believe, comprehend the true threat of communism. I'm quite concerned about the war in Ukraine on many different levels. So I want to get to this question that I was asked. And if any of you ever have questions that you want me to answer, especially on air, leave them in the comment section. I typically answer questions, send them in an email. Most of y'all should know my email, AmericanVindictaShow@gmail.com. So this is a question. This guy says, quick question, what are we doing in Ukraine? I've heard it is the most corrupt country in Europe. if not the world. Burisma Holdings, anyone. Also, I've heard they have had a statue of Stefan Bandera. Hardcore followers of Bandera are in Ukraine. I've been following Colonel McGregor for a while and a few other people reporting on Ukraine. Also, the same media that lied about Trump and the Russian collusion are now telling us another story. Guys, I like to really analyze info. Any you'd be willing to share would be really appreciated. Semper Fi. Well, Semper Fidelis, devil. This is my response. All right. The overall goal for Ukraine is provocation, to provoke a nuclear strike of any capacity, small or large, by Russia on any NATO asset. Even a strike in Ukraine in a limited fashion would be considered a green light for attacking Russia, and Putin knows it. While that is going on, there is a plethora of other issues. You have human trafficking. You have organ harvesting. Sex slaves. You have embezzlement. Fraud. You have strategic movement of military assets to Poland and other countries, creating the first governmental system of infrastructure for a digital ID to include the passport, the immunization history, and digital currency. We have movement of biological weapons, and it's ongoing research that the USA and other countries have there. Also, alliances from other nations that have banded together to help bankrupt the BRICS nations. Also, slowly chewing apart the Russian military and its assortment of arms and armament, while also trying to stir up the threat of nuclear war against Russia so that either A, someone will assassinate Putin, or B, we'll have one of our assets assassinate Putin and blame it on the invasion into Ukraine. I think one of the many goals is to start a revolution in Russia, to start a civil war in Russia, something that we can very quickly come down upon. You have to ask yourself, what's the end goal here? Like I said, we know what the end goal is. Just by what the Bible has told us, the end goal is the New World Order, the beast system. But that's the enemy's end goal, of which I'm really not concerned of, because prophecy tells me that that's going to happen no matter what. Your end goal should be your own survival, preparation for this next war. Prepare your soul, your family, your loved ones. You know, if I had a time machine, I would go back to World War II just to go to Nazi Germany, just to hear what the kids were saying in the schools, what they were saying in the diners, because I'm quite sure that it would be very similar to what I've been hearing over the past couple of years here in America. It's all politics. It's all politics. So one of the actual reasons why the forefathers wanted a king out of George Washington, someone like a monarch who could rule, even though we would have constitutional rights, they understood that one man in a military capacity would be able to hold down the future revolutions and rebellions that they had started. They knew that since they had started it, more would come. But instead, Washington also foresaw this and knew that whoever was crowned king next would have the authority to do what was already happening to them then, and to just repeat the Revolutionary War. So it's quite a conundrum. But once again, let's just look back into the past. Let's have a reflection for today. I try sometimes not to be in the most bitterest of moods when I think about politicians. I heard Lindsey Graham the other day saying that the money that's been spent in Ukraine to kill Russians has been the best money that we've ever spent. Men like that, cowardly, sweaty-palmed, limp-wristed, little girly men like Lindsey Graham, sweetheart Lindsey Graham, the reprobate himself. And that'll come out one day. Men like this, he reminds me of a Himmler in a lot of ways. Yeah, he was in the National Guard or Air Guard. But once again, he never thrusted himself into combat. But he's more than willing to send me back, or to send you back, or your kids. Men like that in politics, they have no place there. This has been the problem with our political system. War hawks. They get money from the war that they start. Anyways, we're going to read from World War II, an illustrated history. The book was wrote by Donald Somerville. I would like to read you the introduction and then a few chapters before we end today. For some of you, this may be completely new news to you about the history of World War II. World War II is so important because it will be vastly different compared to World War III, so says the experts. Which, by the way, the experts say that World War III will probably last a couple hours, not a couple years or more. Let's begin. Within a few years of its end, many people in the victorious countries were questioning if World War I has been a just and necessary war. This has never been true of World War II, either in the immediate aftermath or in longer historical retrospect. The unmitigated evil at the heart of Hitler's Germany and the unrestrained cruelty of the Japanese regime to its prisoners and subjects were both so plain that at the time and since, few have argued that it was a war that was not worth fighting. Although the world soon moved into the Cold War, an era of potentially even more dangerous confrontation, a few have ever suggested that the Allies' lives lost in the war were lives sacrificed in vain. Far more than any previous major war, World War II saw civilians effectively in the front line. In part, this arose from the murderous nature of the totalitarian regimes of Hitler and Stalin and the vicious racism of Japan's militarists. But the Anglo-American bombing campaigns meant that those countries' leaders also had far from clean hands. Unlike World War I, the first war of the combat aircraft, the tank, and the submarine, there were no new types of weapon of any importance introduced until almost the end of the war. The major military development was the extension of the use of air power to a level far beyond anything previously attempted or contemplated. Developments in radio and electronics also meant that both in air and on the ground, operations could be directed with a new level of sophistication. Tank commanders could talk to each other. Aircraft could be detected hundreds of miles away, and radar could find the periscope of a submerged submarine at sea. The war's one new weapon was obviously the atom bomb, which clearly changed the nature of warfare for all time. Its level of destructive power was so great that even when nuclear retaliation was possible, its owners might hesitate to use it. was such a dire threat to the future of humankind in existence. It was in a sense just as well that people had seen the flattened cityscape of Hiroshima and heard the dreadful evidence of the horrors of the Holocaust. The propagation of such knowledge of just how terrible wars can be may have served to make people and governments more likely to resolve their differences peacefully. This is perhaps the lasting benefit that World War II brought. World War I, the war to end all wars, had been centered in Europe, but in fact it solved few of Europe's problems. Indeed, it established other problems that the dictators and militarists of the 1930s would exploit to achieve their ends, or so they hoped. But instead, this went on to create a new and more terrible conflict. World War I had been the most costly conflict in human history, both in terms of loss of life and in physical destruction. Not only the killing, but the whole process of war production had been thoroughly mechanized and industrialized. Previous standards of humane conduct and types of weapons used and the involvement of civilians were also quickly disregarded. World War II would take all these trends to new extremes. Germany's ability to dominate Europe had not been removed by World War I. The public will for this to happen remained a force in German life, not just for Hitler and for his fellow fascists. Similarly, Japan's leaders' victorious allies in World War I came to feel that they had been denied their just rewards and their national destiny was being circumscribed by racist Europeans and Americans. In these tough economic times, other nations failed to respond well to such issues. Some chose isolationism, others negotiation, and its feeble cousin, appeasement, backed by a half-hearted rearmament. When faced with enemies who were happy to start wars whenever it suited them, these strategies were inadequate. We'll move on to failing economies. The years immediately after World War I saw many hardships and political problems for people all around the world, not just in defeated Germany. Both the Nazi Party and the Italian fascism had their origins in this period. Then, after a period of growing prosperity and seeming progress toward international amity, the collapse of American shared prices in 1929 ushered in the Great Depression and an era of political turmoil. And all the former warring countries, ex-soldiers had to find their way back into civil society, but did not always find jobs easy to come by. The many disabled veterans found life particularly difficult. Poverty was an everyday reality for millions of war widows and orphans. Those higher up the social scale worried that the turmoil of Russia's communist revolution might spread. In Germany, right-wingers formed militias to fight socialists and revolutionaries. And in Britain and in other countries, troops clashed in the streets with strikers and other protesters. With its economic struggles, Germany fell behind in its reparations payments. In retaliation, French and Belgian troops occupied the Ruhr in January 1923, an action that triggered a financial crisis and massive inflation in Germany. By late 1923, the mark's foreign exchange value was 130 billion to the dollar. In Germany, money was virtually worthless paper, and many in the middle classes saw their savings wiped out. American loans. In 1924, an Allied committee, which led by American banker Charles Dawes, shortly to become U.S. Vice President, set up a new plan for Germany's reparations payments, which brought stability and growth to the German economy, but only on the back of U.S. loans. Other countries were also heavily indebted to the USA for loans raising during World War I. They, too, struggled to repay these because of a decline in international trade. partly caused by USA's protectionist measures. For the moment, however, the American economy and stock market were booming, while in international affairs there seemed to be other promising signs. In 1926, Germany joined the League of Nations and seemed to be reasonably stable in its domestic politics, even though radical parties of both left and right had significant followings. In 1928, a range of leading nations even signed a treaty called the Kellogg-Briand Pact, after the U.S. Secretary of State and the French foreign minister who led the negotiations, by which they agreed to renounce the use of aggressive war as an instrument of national policy. Obviously, this agreement did not fulfill its aims, but it has remained important in international law. It would be used after World War II to support a number of charges made against the leaders of Germany and Japan by the International War Crimes Tribunals. In 1929, a plan proposed by Owen Young, another American banker, finally fixed the amount of war reparations Germany still had to pay. Though the terms were milder than those previously in force, many Germans still believed they were overly harsh, even if they allowed this issue finally to be closed. Economic collapse. Then, in October 1929, prices collapsed on New York Stock Exchange, and the credit that had financed the USA's own economic growth and kept many foreign economies healthy dried up. Soon, there would be millions of unemployed in all industrialized nations and great opportunities for politicians offering radical solutions to these problems. So thus far, what we've learned is that politics drives war, right? And it's our politicians driving us to war right now in Ukraine. But not just in Ukraine. War with China. War against the cartels in Mexico, says Lindsey Graham. War on the police. War on drugs. War on gender. War on religion. War on oil. War on medicine. How about war on politics? Donald Trump is about to be indicted again for Mar-a-Lago. Surely our politicians will benefit from all of these, what were they called? Radical solutions. Let's move on to fascism and Nazism. In Italy, and then in Germany, radical political movements with dominating leaders took control of the governments, and then the whole of nation life, remaking these countries in a new, violent, intolerant, and ultra-nationalist form. What's interesting is this is what the Democrats and liberals said about Donald Trump and all of his supporters. You've heard them. Our current president said that anyone who supports Trump or who belongs to MAGA is a terrorist, an enemy to this country. See, what they say is that we're an enemy to the country, that we are domestic terrorists, violent. You know what's interesting? Is to them, in their country, the idea that their America should be, which is a communist America, a fascist America, they would be right. Because we don't agree with that. We won't allow that. We won't just go along with the plan. What did Hillary call us all? Deplorable. Both Italy and Germany saw much use of violence to suppress strikes and socialist activities immediately after World War I. In Italy, the National Fascist Party, which was led by journalist and war veteran Benito Mussolini, was prominent in these activities. Backed by numerous party thugs, the Black Shirts, Mussolini took advantage of continuing political instability to have himself appointed prime minister in 1922. Now, if you do remember, Antifa, the anti-fascists, which are legitimately communist, as they say, and are fascist, this is one of their idols. The Black Shirts, the enforcing party of the Italian fascists, the Italian communists. How stupid do they think we are? Mussolini's message was ultra-nationalist and stated that the good of the nation came before any individual rights or liberties. Elections were first rigged and then abolished, as were political parties and the freedom of speech. Fascist organizations were set up in every walk of life, starting with one for boys of 6 and up. 6 years old and up. Now, Mussolini himself became El Duce, the leader, and took unchallenged control of the government, supported by propaganda that had claimed, among other things, that Mussolini is always right. All right, this use of propaganda is exactly what you see now in American politics. The left is always right. The right is always wrong. Orange man bad. Now then, we have Hitler. Hitler's rise to power in Germany followed a very similar, though rather longer, route. After building his tiny little political party, renamed the National Socialist German Workers' Party, into a significant local force, Hitler mounted an attempted coup in Munich in 1923. This beer hall push failed, and Hitler was jailed for quite a time. However, he did gain a national reputation from that event, and one of his co-conspirators was General Erich Ludendorff, one of Germany's most famous soldiers from World War I. In jail, Hitler wrote his political manifesto, Mein Kampf, which usually is translated as My Struggle, which set out very clearly the core of his beliefs. He had a hatred of Jews and of communists and an intention to gain new territory for the German race in Eastern Europe, the Lebensraum, or living space. When the Nazis took power, Hitler and his party remained fairly minor players until the world economic crash began in 1929. So, prior to that big economic crash, you had competing ideologies of fascism and communism. And then when money went to nothing, these groups were able to rise up and during a time of chaos, took advantage of people who were jobless, homeless, they couldn't pay for anything, and thus they were able to grab the mind, the very heart of the people who were afflicted by this. Desperate people in desperate times taking desperate measures. And you will always have a character there who will take advantage of despotism. When Hitler was allied with big business interests, and he started preaching that Germany's ills were actually caused from abroad and by the detested Treaty of Versailles. Hitler found a new substantial support. In 1932, the Nazis became the largest party in the Reichstag, which is Germany's parliament. And after further elections and some complicated political maneuvering, Hitler was then appointed as chancellor at the head of a multi-party government by President Hindenburg in January of 1933, though Hindenburg was kind of pushed into electing him as the chancellor. By late 1934, after Hindenburg's death, Hitler had taken complete control and ruled with legally acquired emergency powers. The problem here in America is we have the Emergency Powers Act that the presidents have that is uncontested. Nobody ever disbands that. Nobody ever takes that off the table. Bush didn't. Clinton didn't. Reagan didn't. All right. Trump didn't. Obama didn't. And Biden won't. It's a lot of danger when you have the ability to declare supreme power. But when Hitler had taken that complete control, he became the Führer, the leader, the national leader, combining the offices of both the president and the chancellor. So all opposition of political parties were then banned. Concentration camps, the Gestapo's secret police, and the rest of the apparatus of a police state were then established. And the members of Germany's armed forces all swore a loyalty of oath to Hitler personally. One of the things I've recently seen happen in Congress was with the FBI whistleblowers and the Democrats who were saying, who did you swear your oath of allegiance to? To the country? To we the people? Because what they make it sound like is to the president and his party. That's the way it comes across, doesn't it? Because the oath of allegiance should see no party lines. This is the problem, once again, with ruling political parties, either leftist or right. And we do have a secret police. It's been exposed. It is the FBI and others like it. If anything, the problem here in America is that we are so much more adapted at using the technology at hand through spying on Americans and artificial intelligence. I'll play a clip here soon to prove that. That Americans can no longer be free. Not in the sense that we were prior. And it can never go back to the way it was. Because these ruling powers will never relinquish the reins of control. And the problems only keep growing.
In 1975, the late Senator Frank Church said, "The United States government has perfected a technological capability that enables us to monitor messages that go through the air. That capability at any time could be turned around on the American people, and no American would have any privacy left. Such is the capability to monitor everything. There would be no place to hide." These words came as Senator Church led the Senate Select Committee to study governmental operations with respect to intelligence activities, better known as the Church Committee. The Church Committee's 1976 final report exposed numerous secret federal programs that violated the constitutional rights of American citizens. It deemed these threats, to existing social and political order. These programs surveilled and targeted individuals like Martin Luther King Jr. and domestic organizations like the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, as well as infiltrated movements to incite rivalries and discredit leaders. Nearly 50 years later, Senator Church's ominous warning that the government could weaponize technology against the American people reads more like a premonition. There is truly becoming no place to hide. In recent decades, journalists and whistleblowers exposed the examples of our government leveraging emerging technologies to violate the privacy and civil liberties of its citizens. Intelligence agencies conducted surveillance of video game users, collecting data on the contents of communications between players. The Department of Homeland Security tracked the locations of individuals and groups participating in the Black Lives Matter movement. The Drug Enforcement Administration conducted covert surveillance of people protesting the death of George Floyd. And it's only getting worse. Just last month, the ACLU acknowledged the Biden administration has been quietly deploying and expanding programs that surveil what people say on social media, using tools that allows agents and analysts to visibly monitor the vast amount of protected speech that occurs online. And how are they doing it? Using artificial intelligence. For years, federal agencies, including the Department of Homeland Security, State Department, National Science Foundation, and FBI have been colluding with private organizations and social media companies to combat what they deem to be disinformation. Jacob Siegel in Tablet wrote, "Disinformation is both the name of the crime and the means to covering it up, a weapon that doubles as a disguise." I think that's an apt way of looking at disinformation. It's a tool for those who want to limit speech, but it also doubles as a disguise and a means of covering up what they're actually trying to do. The purpose, so they claimed, was to combat foreign malign influence. But in reality, the government wasn't suppressing foreign misinformation or disinformation. It was working to censor domestic speech by Americans. Since 2020, the federal government has awarded over 500 contracts and grants related to misinformation or disinformation. George Orwell would be proud. While the grant awardees and their proprietary AI and machine learning technologies differ, their goals are consistent: to mine the internet, identify conversations indicative of harmful narratives, track those threats, and develop countermeasures before messages go viral. One National Science Foundation-funded company's mission statement claims that social media is being manipulated and ideas are being spread uncontrollably online. The solution it provides? An automatic controversy detection algorithm to help identify things that are potentially opinion-shifting in order to make communication more productive and less dangerous. In other words, censorship. During the COVID-19 pandemic, we witnessed accelerated use of artificial intelligence technologies to monitor and suppress public debate on issues like natural immunity, masks, and the origin of the virus. Multiple federal agencies, including DOD and the State Department, funded automated disinformation detection technologies designed to monitor and suppress public debate on issues like vaccine and the origins of COVID-19. Writer Jacob Siegel, in a fantastic yet haunting narrative explaining the last decade of U.S. government domestic censorship efforts, said, "Disinformation now and for all time is whatever they say it is." That is not a sign that the concept is being misused or corrupted. It is the precise functioning of a totalitarian system. Make no mistake, the United States is engaging in the same activities we criticize other countries for. But unlike China and North Korea, the United States government attempts to conceal its involvement using private entities as front companies to do their dirty work. But make no mistake, the intent is the same: control the narrative, eliminate dissent, and retain power. This should terrify all Americans. The government is using your hard-earned tax dollars to surveil and censor your protected speech. Artificial intelligence is only going to make it easier for the government to do this and harder to detect. This should not be a partisan issue. We must get to the bottom of how the federal government uses artificial intelligence to violate the privacy and civil liberties of the American people before it's too late.
In 1934, Hitler also confirmed that his own supremacy within the Nazi movement in the Night of the Long Knives. The party's left wingers and the leader of the party militia, the SA, or the Brown Shirts, were among those that were killed. The SS, the Schutzstaffel, led by Heinrich Himmler, became more important. Legal persecution of Germany's Jews began in earnest with the Nuremberg Laws of 1935, which withdrew many civil rights, and at the same time, Jews suffered increasingly from thuggery and intimidation. See, with the Nuremberg Laws, you got to understand something, that the Germans, the Nazi Party, legally wrote it into law with their courts that they could take away civil rights from certain groups of people, could put them in concentration camps, could rob from them, could steal from them, and then legally liquidate them, which means to kill in an industrialized size millions of people. It authorized construction, funding, slave labor, the ability for us would be posse comitatus. It authorized the restructuring of law enforcement underneath the Schutzstaffel, the secret police, the SS. And then it also allowed for the National Guard to be also put in with the order police. And from there, the atrocities began. But it was government that led it. It was the laws wrote by the lawyers. It was the lawyers, by the way, who wrote the law. It was the military apparatus who enforced the law, all by a political faction who created this entire problem that once again we get to deal with. And in Ukraine, that guy, Stefan Bandera, was a Nazi, was an ardent Nazi supporter. He has an entire following. I think it's January 1st is Stefan Bandera Day. And this is what we're sending our money to. This is what we're sending our weapons of war to. This is what we want to send our men and women to go and fight and die for people who still honor, even worship the idea of Nazism. Heaven forbid. Let's talk about aggression from Europe and Asia. World War II began, some would say, in September of 1931, when Japan attacked and, in effect, annexed the Chinese province of Manchuria. The attack was inspired by a conspiracy of middle-ranking Japanese army officers who faked a sabotage incident on the South Manchurian Railway owned by the Japanese. The government in Tokyo knew nothing of this, but went along with events when a full-scale advance was immediately started. Throughout the approach to war, both the Japanese army and navy and factions within them would, in effect, be laws unto themselves. In February 1932, Manchuria was declared independent by the Japanese as Manchukuo, but in reality, it was a puppet state economically exploited under Japanese control. In 1933, when a League of Nations investigation finally stated what was obvious, that Japan was the aggressor, Japan simply left the League and increased its military budget. And then we have the Nazi threat. So Hitler also left the League in 1933, ostensibly because other countries had refused to disarm to Germany's level, but the reality was much different. In 1935, he reintroduced compulsory military service and announced the existence of a German air force, both outright violations of the Treaty of Versailles. Britain, France, and at this stage, Italy condemned these moves, but this was all a sham. Later the same summer, without prior consultation with France, Britain concluded the Anglo-German Naval Agreement, specifically allowing the expansion of the German Navy and the creation of a U-boat force. Now, with the explanation here of Germany's Air Force, for a period of years, because they weren't allowed to have an Air Force, what Germany did, what Hitler did, was he said he wanted to expand the ability for Germans to have a commercialized air transport system, kind of like what we have today with your commercial airports. But in reality, it was all militaristic. All they had to do was retrofit the planes with the bombs and the guns. And thus, by the time the war started, the Air Corps was already there. Italy was next to make a move. Aware of the country's modest resources, Mussolini's government had not sought gains abroad in the first decade of fascist rule, though it had brutally consolidated control over Italy's existing colonies throughout Africa. However, in October of 1935, Italy attacked Abyssinia. By May 1936, it had completed the annexation despite half-hearted sanctions introduced by the League of Nations. Encouraged by this, in March of 1936, Hitler sent troops into the Rhineland area, demilitarized by the Versailles terms. Again, all Britain and France could muster were brief protests. Hitler made his move despite opposition from his generals, and by being proved right, his control over them was made more secure, and his belief in his own military judgment was more confirmed. In February 1938, he completed his hold over his armed forces by dismissing the two top generals, the war minister and the commander-in-chief, taking over the supreme command himself. In March 1938, the next step was to merge Austria into Germany, sending troops across the border after Austrian Nazis had destabilized the government. Clearly, this was not going to be his last target. And then you have war in China, and then you have stuff going on across the USSR. We have more atrocities that start over Europe. America starts to get a little bit more indulged into the war and so on and so forth. I suggest if you want to learn more about history, you pick up the book, World War II, an Illustrated History. I know I've ranted and raved a little bit. I hate the way our country is going. I'm not going to lie to you. I despise our politicians. 95 or 96% of them, at least. And that's why I continue to tell people to train, prep, and pray. We can't convince our politicians not to take us into war, obviously. They're guided by other means, money, motivations, power. But we can all see this coming. But what history has proved over and over again is on the back of an economic collapse, war springs up. What has everybody been warning? An economic collapse is coming to America. So, hold fast. Be ready. If you get the chance, thank a veteran for their service. But remember this, no man is free who is not master of himself. Get your mind right with God. Get your heart right with God. That freedom should start within yourself and should spread out to your family first before you try to take it to other people's shores. I wish here in America we would work on our own problems before trying to go and solve them around the world. Stay frosty, guys. I'll see you tomorrow.
All stations, all call signs. Prepare for transmission. This is Wrecker Actual. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord. End of transmission.